Can you hear me?
Yes, good. Okay. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to LSE. I am Valentino Larcinese. I'm a professor here at LSE in the Roman Department. I'm delighted to be chairing this public lecture, which is hosted by the LSE Roman Department and marks the launch of a book on the political economy of Italy's decline by Andrea Capossela. This book is published by Oxford University Press. It's been published this year. In this public lecture, Andrea will present the main findings of the book and his explanations for the Italian economic troubles. So what are these troubles and why the world decline? I would, of course, be even more delighted to be chairing an event about Italy's economic success. And it's very unfortunate that, in fact, the Italian economy has been performing pretty badly on a number of virtually any dimension or indicator you may want to consider for at least 20 years. And particularly since the financial crisis of 2008 and the Great Recession, let me remind you that still today, Italian GDP, real GDP, is about 5% lower than what it was at the peak in 2008. Right? So this performance, this dismal performance, has led commentators and scholars to explicitly talk about decline. Okay, so a long-term tendency rather than some short-term temporary negative shock. Right. So and tonight what we'll try to do is to try to understand what's the matter with Italy, with the help of our speakers, Andrea Lorenzo Capossela and Bill Lemmott. I'm very pleased to welcome them to the LSE. So let me say a few words about our guests. Andrea Capossela served as the head of the economics unit of Kosovo International Supervisor, the International Civilian Office, in 2008-2011. And then he was advisor to the Moldova Ministers of the Economy and Deputy Prime Minister on behalf of the European Union. He's the author of another book on Kosovo, State Building in Kosovo, Democracy, Corruption, and the EU in the Balkans. Andrea's lecture will be followed by discussion by Bill Lemmott, former editor-in-chief of The Economist. Bill knows a lot about Italy, I would say, and I'm confident many people in the audience still remember some of the covers of The Economist at the time about famous billionaire, we will not mention him tonight, at the time used to run, was used to be the prime minister of Italy, right? So on Italy's, in particular, economic and social decline, he has authored a book, Good Italy, Bad Italy, co-authored a documentary, Girlfriend in a Coma. And his latest book is The Fate of the West, The Battle to Save the World, the Most Successful Political Idea. So let me remind you that if you want to tweet about this event, the recommended hashtag is LSE Italy. And, well, without further ado, let me leave the floor to Andrea.
Thank you very much, Valentino. It's an honor to be here. This is the cover of the book. There is a spiral there, as you can see, a downward spiral. You probably already guessed why, based on what Valentino said. I'll say more about it, but first let me say what it is. It is a staircase designed by the architect Borromini for the Barberini Palace in Rome, which houses an important old master's collection. It is a secondary staircase, in fact. The main one was designed by Borromini's rival, Bernini, more known as a sculptor, which is also a spiral, by the way, but a square one. They were designed in the 1630s, which is about one century into a long period of decline and stagnation that Italy underwent between, symbolically, the sack of Rome of 1527 and the very end of the 19th century. Italy now seems to be declining again. And I try in this book to explain why. here is the main question I try to answer. This is total factor productivity, TFP, also called the solar residual. This variable is a component of an economy's overall productivity, and it measures roughly technological and organizational progress. It measures the innovation in the technologies used by an economy and in the way capital and labor are combined. And growth theory tells us that TFP is the critical component of long-term growth, and even more importantly, it is a main driver of the rise of living standards. These curves show the TFP performance of Italy and five other countries, which are closely comparable to it, which will appear also in the other figures. And the curves show their performance relative to the world's productivity frontier, which for this period can be identified with the average productivity level of the US economy. So when the curve goes up, it means that the country is converging on the frontier. When it goes down, it is diverging from the frontier. But of course, they go up and down relative to a moving target, because the frontier itself is moving. It's slowly advancing. So a falling curve does not necessarily mean that the absolute level of TFP in an economy is going down, but rather that the rate at which it grows is lower than the rate at which the frontier progresses. Now, after the Renaissance, as I said, Italy had three or perhaps four centuries of decline. The country was unified near the end of this period, in 1861. For the following three decades, it still was losing ground relative to the countries that industrialized first, Britain, of course, but also France, Germany, the US. Then catch up began in the mid-1890s. It was interrupted by fascism. It resumed after the war. And this is where the figure picks it up. As you can see, Italy's performance, it is the black full line. Italy's performance during the first half of this period was admirable. The peak of Italy's convergence to the frontier, 1980, was well above the frontier and higher than anyone else's. But then, as you can see, convergence turned into divergence, which continues to this day. This turning point is emphasized here. These are the same curves of the previous graph, normalized to 1980. So what you see here is how each economy fared in the four decades after 1980, each relative to the position they had in 1980. The position, I mean, in terms of convergence to the frontier. The mirroring extremes, as you can see, are Germany and Italy. Germany is now some 30% above what it was in 1980. Italy is 30% below. As you can see, there is a broader phenomenon of productivity slowdown in the Western world, but the gap between Italy and its peers suggests that Italy has some additional problems. To illustrate the effects of the fall in TFP growth, here is a decomposition of growth from a standard growth accounting exercise. The contribution of TFP growth, which is in light gray in the columns, is strong throughout and beyond the so-called golden age, which is this long, happy period of European capitalism between the war and more or less 1973, when the first oil shock and the end of the Bretton Woods system opened a period of much greater macroeconomic instability. After the 70s, TFP growth slowed down, as we saw, and drags the growth rate down with it. The aggregate growth rate is the black diamond in each column. Note that capital growth, which is in slightly darker gray, just above, in the columns just above TFP, remains fairly high throughout this period, and accelerates after the collapse of TFP growth. This growth model, relying much less on TFP and much more on capital growth, allowed a respectable growth rate in the middle period, 1980 to 92. As you can see, the growth was, well, close to 2.5%, which was, I think, still the fastest in the Western world in that period. And by the way, the big fall of the growth rate between the 70s and the 80s is an entirely physiological one. It is due to the fact that the so-called advantage of backwardness was declining. That is, the advantage that backward countries have in catching up fast with other economies, because they simply import their technologies and they use these technologies in the sectors where they're most productive, while shifting resources into those sectors from more traditional ones. But this model, based on capital growth, as you can see from the following period, 1993-2007, which apparently worked well until then, and then breaks down. The growth rate in this period, 93-07, in Italy, was about half the average of the Eurozone, of the to become Eurozone. So with a lag of about a decade, we see the fall of TFP growth, and we see some problems also, presumably, in the quality of investment, because the investment rate remains high. But probably this money goes into less investment of less quality, which, as we can see, has a smaller yield in terms of aggregate growth. So the two phenomena may be linked, and I'll return to this. Now, the literature that started studying this unusually low growth in Italy has, over time, identified a fairly reliable and a fairly uniform set of factors. Here you see the reasons that are most commonly identified as the main proximate causes of Italy's economic decline, or Italy's economic malaise, it was the expression used in that period. I will just mention one thing about the last one, low skills trap, because it is the first example of a vicious circle. This is from a recent OECD study, which notes that the low supply of skills, supply from the education system to the economy, is accompanied by low demand by firms for skills. And this lowers the pressure on the education system and the political system, therefore, lowers the pressure to improve the performance of the education sector and lowers the incentive of students to acquire higher skills because firms don't seem to need them much and therefore are unable to reward them properly. Because of all this, this is the conclusion, the four big shocks that changed the economic context after the 90s, globalization, ICT revolution, the rise of China and India, the euro, which could have been opportunities for growth, became fetters, became obstacles to growth instead in Italy. The literature often stops here, and this is entirely understandable because if you move beyond proximate causes, you go into increasingly uncertain territory. And to find a lead into this territory, I propose to have a closer look at one of these factors, the misallocation of resources. Now, here I quote a study published 2 years ago by the European Commission, a very useful study, entitled Italy's Productivity Conundrum. Its authors define misallocation as dispersion of TFP performance across firms. So we're still talking about the very first graph, TFP. And the reasoning behind this idea is more or less this. In a market economy, two main forces push capital and labor towards the most productive firms and the most productive sectors. One is product market competition, which rewards productivity and tends to push unproductive firms out of the market. The other one is the competitiveness and the fluidity of the factor markets, where labor and capital are exchanged, which are the channels through which this flow of resources from less to more productive firms and sectors occurs. So if these two forces are powerful, misallocation will be low, and vice versa. As you can see, this study finds that misallocation grew in Italy over the past quarter century, more or less. They find that the problem is a horizontal one, appearing in all sectors and across all location and size classes, groups of firms grouped according to size or location. And interestingly, the problem has worsened more, especially in the high echelons of the of Italian capitalism, in the Northwest, which is the area that drove Italy's convergence, and among large firms, which were and remain of systemic importance. This is to be read next to subsequent empirical research, which shows that the intensity of competition, of product market competition, has grown in Italy in this period. And it has grown chiefly because of external reasons, the single European market and the euro. So one of these two forces was doing well. At least it was intensifying in this period, while misallocation growth. This leads us to think that the main culprit is the other one, namely the factor markets, labor and capital markets, which evidently are not competitive and fluid enough to allow the economy to exploit its potential to the full. But let us park this observation for a minute, because I would like to return to the literature and to the fairly few studies that try to make sense of these empirical results. So these are another empirical results, and who take literature that takes a more historical perspective. Now, this is, in one word, their analysis, which I share and which I take as the basis of my interpretation. In one word, Italy failed at the peak of her success. She performed splendidly as a backward economy that was catching up with more advanced ones and was catching up to the frontier. But when she had to transform herself into an advanced economy, a frontier economy, she hesitated and still hesitates. My own inference linked to this literature, but my own inference is that the reason of this could be problems in Italy's institutions. I mean institutions in the sense used by Douglas North, namely the rules of the game of a society and of an economy. Thus defined, institutions are what governs the product and factor markets and what determines what shapes the incentives to invest and innovate. So they might explain the problems we just saw. And indeed, Italy's institutions do seem to be quite bad. This is from the World Bank's worldwide governance indicators, which are meta-indicators, in fact. They sum up all available and reliable indicators in this field. This particular indicator depicts a macro institution made up of a myriad of micro ones, and it describes an outcome, not an input. So bear in mind this approach. What this describes is the degree to which, in a given country, the law tends to be respected. All measures of the quality of institutions, including this one, are to be taken with great caution. The literature is clear on this. But in this case, the gap that separates Italy from her peers and the clarity of the trend are sufficient for this to be taken seriously, especially as another indicator, which measures the degree to which countries manage to contain corruption, confirms what we just saw. I will not talk about corruption much. I just use this to confirm this other picture. But perhaps do note this. Corruption seems to be rising, namely control corruption is declining. and might well be more widespread now than it was in 92. Unfortunately, 92 is not covered here, but because the measurements begin in 96. But in 92, systemic corruption was unveiled, but what by what to this day remains the largest corruption investigation in post-war Europe, which decimated the economic elite, decapitated the political elite, and led to the dissolution of the five political parties that had governed Italy ever since 1947, in fact. So it is interesting to see that despite this upheaval, corruption seems to be persist and is arguably still systemic. Now, the picture as to the quality of institution doesn't change if we move from macro to micro and from the public to the private sector. This is an indicator of the degree to which a country's firms protect the interests of the minority shareholders. Now, if you return to the list of the proximate causes of decline, arguably the main one is that Italy's firms are, on average, smaller than firms in comparable countries, and they tend to grow and innovate less. One reason for this is that Italian firms rely disproportionately on debt financing, loans. And we know from theory and empirical research that debt financing tends to favor growth and innovation less than equity financing. So here we may have an explanation. Italian firms use comparatively less equity capital and therefore grow and innovate comparatively less because they treat minority shareholders comparatively badly, creating a strong disincentive for people to invest in firms that they don't control or that are not owned by their own family. Now, treating shareholders badly. Now, most of the time, this means that the majority shareholder, is predating on them. They are extracting the so-called private benefits of corporate control, which are all direct or indirect way of, in effect, stealing money from the minority shareholders. So here we may have another vicious circle, and because to a large extent, innovation and predation are two alternative routes to profits. You can take one or the other, but it's difficult to combine them. And then the prevalence of one or the other tends to drag other people to follow it. If too many majority shareholders prefer making profits by predating on minority shareholders, then these minority shareholders will start expecting to be treated more badly than before. Then equity capital will become more expensive because they will want to be rewarded for the risk of being ill-treated. And the innovation route to profits will become more difficult. Therefore, more majority shareholders will choose the predation route, and so on. We have a confirmation, if you like, here. Reliable accounts are part of shareholders' protection because shareholders need reliable accounts to decide on their original investment and then need them to get their fair share of the company's profits. So here we have more or less a second perspective on that same vicious circle because one cannot extract sizable private benefits of corporate control while being impeccable on the accounting standards. But the same, a similar vicious circle could also exist between debt financing and the prevalence in Italy of so-called relationship banking. If firms' account are in general not reliable because too many majority shareholders cook the books, then one will tend to get loans mainly from banks that know the company well enough to be able to read through the accounts, to spot the problems, but also to see the value behind the accounts. This favors close relationships between firms and banks. This arguably doesn't help a lot in banking, in competition within the banking sector. But even more importantly, this doesn't help new firms or new entrants in a market because they typically lack an established relationship with a bank or with banks that specialize in the sector. And if relationships become too close, they might breed collusion or even a lowering of credit standards. And this might explain at least part of the problem, of the colossal problem of bad loans, which exploded in Italy a couple of years ago. The same could be said for tax evasion, obviously, because you cannot make accurate accounts while not paying the taxes that they show, but also with corruption. As one cannot post a bribe in one's financial accounts, one must have slush funds out of which to pay it. So to some extent, also corruption and tax evasion are alternative routes to profits to innovation. And they are also consistent with the, on average, lower quality of corporate governance standards that we do observe in Italy. Now, of course, I'm not saying that all companies do all this, not at all. But enough do it for these vicious circles to exist in some degree, and for this to make the overall business environment unfriendly to companies that seek to take the innovation route. This means that successful Italian companies had to overcome generally greater obstacles to success than companies in comparable countries, and that many companies that would be successful in another economy, in a better governed economy, in Italy are simply living by, are simply, or maybe stagnating. To give you an image of what I mean, in Italy's business environment, there is, say, 10% less oxygen than in other ones. So very fit runners would do well regardless, but all others tend to struggle. Now, if what I said sounds plausible, and I tend to hope it does, it is also true that any interpretation that blames institutions meets two obvious objections. The first is that these institutional problems are all very old and did not prevent Italy's genuinely admirable convergence to the, well, transition from backwardness to prosperity. The second objection is that since 1990, exactly, the country was literally flooded with reforms. So institutions should have, if anything, improved, not worsened. So the second objection is even stronger than the first, because it argues, it is predicated on the assumption that growth and institutional quality seemed to be going in opposite direction. Institutions were particularly bad while growth was very high, and as institutions began to improve, growth dropped. This is the objection. And this is also where some of the literature, I think, gets stuck, because both objections, I think, have an answer. The answer to the first one lies in the theory, in my view, in the theory of appropriate institutions, which was formulated by Alexander Gershenkron in the early 60s and later developed, especially within the Schumpeterian strand of growth theory, which, by the way, I took as a guide for this book, precisely because it has a more historical approach. In short, according to this theory, institutions and development should evolve in parallel, together, because institutions that are capable of sustaining catch-up growth, of sustaining the convergence of a backward economy to the frontier through structural change and technology input, may not be the same, and in fact often prove inadequate, to sustain growth at the frontier. There are two growth models there. This argument points the finger, especially to two macro institutions, the rule of law and competition policy. There are solid theoretical reasons and reliable empirical evidence that the rule of law and competition don't seem to matter much in the catch-up phase while you are converging on the frontier. But they become increasingly important as you approach the frontier, such that they can hold up growth at the frontier. As both competition and the rule of law are comparatively weak in Italy, I think the institutional explanation can hold. Now, what about the reforms, the second objection? The answer here is that institutions or rules of the game are to be understood as composite things. They are composed, North says, of formal institutions, informal institutions, and the way in which they interact and are enforced. Institutions are not just laws, which are formally the rules of the game, but they are also the way in which each law is enforced in practice, and the way in which each law interacts with other ones, and especially interacts with the social norms, which are typically pre-existing to the law and they have older origins. Italy's reforms merely touched the formal institutions, the laws. There was a lot of rewriting of laws, but practices didn't change very much. And here we have, I think, a very persuasive theoretical explanation, thanks to work done by Douglas North again and collaborators during the first decade of this century. They show very persuasively, I think, that institutions are rooted, embedded, if you will, in what they call the social order of a country, which may be described as the allocation of power, political and economic, or the politico-economic equilibrium of the country. When they are stable, these equilibria have an internal coherence, a logic, which is capable of bending laws that are inconsistent with it. And they bend laws precisely by enforcing them in a way that distorts the reform or the new law, and by allowing them to be undermined by the pre-existing social norms. I'll return to this, but this is why I think Italy's reforms largely failed. Competition policy is one example. I said it became more intense in the last quarter century. There was a big reform in 1990, which adopted in Italy for the domestic markets the same rules that we had at the EU level, but the effects were very modest. Competition became more intense, empirical research shows, only or chiefly because of external reasons, because of the single market and of the euro. Nonetheless, a big question remains. If all this were true, why were these problems not overcome through the majority principle? Italy's politico-economic equilibrium, which feeds the vicious circles I mentioned earlier and other ones, is not simply efficient, but is also unfair, as it tends to protect rents and establish positions and some segments of the elites. So why didn't the country change this equilibrium by deliberate political choice? The main vicious circle, arguably, is that which concerns public services, taxation, and political accountability. If the quality of public services declines one day, we may expect that also the propensity to pay taxes will decline, and that the incentive to engage in clientelism will rise. Clientelism in order, or even corruption, in order to gain, as private benefits, to make up, as private benefits, the declining amount of public services that one receives. If this vicious circle sets in, and my argument is that it has set in Italy a few decades ago, one is likely to see also a decline of political accountability, because clientelism rises, and clientelism is, in fact, the exchange between political support and favors, private goods. You would expect to see a rise in tax evasion, but also a rise of corruption and of collusion between economic and political elites. A spiral, in other words, within which all these vicious circles rotate more or less in unison and reinforce each other. This leads to inefficiency and unfairness, yes, as I said, but some benefit from it. This equilibrium, the main beneficiaries of this equilibrium, are those parts of Italy's political and economic elites that are not particularly enterprising or capable or innovating. Those, in other words, whose opportunities are not curtailed by this equilibrium, by the inefficiency of the system. But why do their interests prevail, which is another way of putting the same question, over those of the rest of society? The answer here, part of the answer here, is that lies in what I call a system of selective inclusion, which was built over decades and is a crucial pillar of this spiral, because it managed to align the interest, at least the individual short-term interests, of several segments of society with the interests of the main beneficiaries of this system. By selective inclusion, I mean chiefly regulatory and welfare policies that were granted to certain categories of citizens or firms particularistic benefits, special benefits, that were valuable enough to align their interests with those with the elite, to turn them into supporters of the status quo. This system was built ever since the middle of the 50s, also in order to, also as part of the struggle between the Western-oriented governing coalition and a communist opposition that soon became the largest communist party in Western Europe, which was closely tied to Moscow, had revolution, its ultimate aim. But the system remained also after the end of the Cold War and survived the reforms of the 90s. So I return to the question. Italy is a democracy. Why didn't it solve this problem through deliberate political action? Having said all this, my answer needs still two premises. The first is that, if I am right, this spiral is an equilibrium. And because of this, the main drivers, and it has established itself over the past few decades, because of this, the main drivers of citizens and firms' political and economic choices, namely institutions, in the sense I said, interpersonal trust, social capital, if you will, culture, even ideas to some extent, all these elements are more or less aligned with the equilibrium. The second premise is that the social dilemmas underlying each of these vicious circles, innovation or predation and so on, are comparable, in my view, to assurance games, not to prisoners' dilemmas. So there are two equilibria. There is the socially undesirable equilibrium is not inevitable. The socially desirable equilibrium, good public services, strong political accountability, tax compliance, and so on, strong rule of law, the socially desirable equilibrium is a possible one and is the preferable one, both individually and collectively. But if one expects that others behave opportunistically, it makes sense to act defensively, to act opportunistically as well. Remember that I'm speaking of ordinary citizens and firms, not the beneficiaries of the system. And I think that for them, the socially desirable equilibrium is also individually desirable, as I said. This means that for them, clientelism, corruption, tax evasion, collusion are all defensive strategies. If so, the trick, so to speak, is to coordinate their expectations towards the socially desirable equilibrium. But the problem is that coordination depends precisely on the factors I mentioned earlier, those which are directly influencing people's choices, institutions, trust, culture, etc. And they are too aligned, because of decades of sedimentation, too aligned with the existing equilibrium to be able to shift expectations towards the upper equilibrium. Now, of course, efficient institutions and strong countervailing forces do exist in Italy. It is fairly respectable, well, used to be a fairly respectable democracy. And they are strong enough to avoid the downward spiral to go down to complete lawlessness. They stopped it somewhere in the middle. But they seem, thus far, they seem to have been unable to shift it to the upper equilibrium, to one upper equilibrium. Now, about two-thirds of the book are dedicated to illustrating this and elaborating this interpretation. And I do it by using this interpretation as a lens to review Italy's history, not to retell it, but to follow the evolution of the social order and the gradual sedimentation of the institutional problems we see today. I begin at unification, go very fast until the end of the last war, and then slow down to look at a few critical passages in the seven decades you see here. I don't propose to make a detailed summary, but I would like to mention one episode at the peak of Italy's economic miracle. Between 58 and 62, a very ambitious reform program was designed through academic work, debates, public debates, also within the colossal, it was then colossal, membership of the main political parties, the Christian Democrats, the Socialists, others, even the Communists. This was arguably the most ambitious reform program in Italy's history since unification. It was comprehensively defeated. And the commentator argues, and I agree with him, that this killed the very idea that deep reform was possible, at least until the 90s. Now, that program was defeated for many reasons. Political and economic, including weaknesses in the program itself, which in many of its parts was strongly dirigist. But one reason for which it was defeated is that a coup d'etat was threatened to scare the reformers. It was threatened by the head of the militarized police, the Carabinieri, acting in consultation with the President of the Republic and fairly wide reactionary circles. This was not decisive in defeating the reform program, and Italy never suffered a coup, so I don't want to exaggerate here. But there is no doubt that for several decades, political violence was an element in the contests about the openness of Italy's social order. This includes the mafia, by the way. The mafia is content and is usually sufficient for the mafia to use the latent, the silent threat of the use of violence to make money. But when the mafia has aims that have a political nature, and sometimes it does, it uses violence. I can just quote a massacre of peasants that occurred in Sicily near Palermo in 1947, right after the left had won the regional elections, the local elections, sorry. And then the terrorist strategy of the mafia in the years 92-93, which killed two famous judges, maybe you remember that, and many ordinary citizens. Like in the early 60s, in that period, the early 90s, the equilibrium could have shifted, arguably, because of a financial and currency crisis in September 92, and because of that colossal corruption investigation. I spent quite some time to explain why the equilibrium, which was mightily shaken, resisted and survived in slightly different form to this day. But maybe we can leave this for the questions and answers, because I would like to quickly return to TFP and growth to conclude. Then let me just say that here you have the origin of some of the discussions of last week, the war of words between Rome and Brussels on the budget deficit. It is a huge problem because, and I can go back in the question and answers, because the public debt was created during the 80s, as you can see here, and it was one of the ways in which Italy offset the decline in TFP growth. It was colossal fiscal expansion, debt-financed. Budget deficits were, on average, close to 11% of GDP per year during this period. It doubled the debt, and unique in Europe, it brought the debt-to-GDP ratio back to the level of the immediate post-war period. Let me just say that, well, maybe a battle of ideas can help us, because ideas are the only component, if you like, the only factor that can influence people's decision that is somewhat free from the grip of the equilibrium. I rely on Roderick and Hirschman to say this. And the idea is that, the equilibrium is weakening because selective inclusion is eroding. Pension reform is just enough to mention this. People are very worried about this and have suffered in the past. So those whose consent was bought with targeted pensions now are being withdrawn. And then there is the argument of the assurance game. The better equilibrium is a possible one. So I conclude that it is possible to invert the rotation of the spiral. This is the same staircase seen from below, with the sky up there. And this maybe is a more cheerful note to, well, maybe a more cheerful image to, on which, against which to discuss. Thank you.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to congratulate Professor Capozzella for his analysis and for his book, which I thoroughly recommend. I think that the great merit of his approach is that he is, if you like, an outsider insider, an insider to his subject, but one who has taken an outside view, not just because he was inspired by being in Kosovo, in a certain sense, but also by taking a much more long-term view of the Italian situation than is normal. To kick off the discussion, I want to just make a limited number of points. One is, I think that alongside that long-term view and the absolutely correct sense of Italy having been a converger and indeed an outperformer up until around 1980, and then a diverger and underperformer after then, we should put Italy's experience into a European context, in that some of that story can be told about the whole of Western Europe, and we must reflect upon that. As a stylized, simplified fact, the charts show that up until the 1980s, really the early 1980s, Western Europe always had lower levels of unemployment than the United States. It's hard to imagine now, but always were lower than the United States, since when they've always been higher. Western Europe as a whole was always catching up, as on that TFP chart, and converging with the United States really until the mid-1990s, early to mid-1990s, since when, taken as a whole, it's been slipping a bit behind. So the Italian story that we have been hearing is of an exaggeration, if you like, an exacerbation of a wider Western European issue, but one in which clearly, particularly since 1980, as Professor Capozzella said, has been considerably underperforming European allies or neighbors. I should add that thinking of the staircase here, that in the documentary that I made with Annalisa Pires, Girlfriend in a Coma, our choice of a spiral was the Pozzo di San Patrizio, St. Patrick's Well in Orvieto, but we used it as a symbol of a descent towards Dante's Inferno. So perhaps we had an even bleaker view at the time. Second point is that really the essential issue that I think Professor Caposella has rightly raised is really the role of rigidity, in the Italian social, political, and economic system. As he said, to some degree, the rigidity increased, but in other senses, the rigidity simply prevented the society and the economy from responding to and catching up with some of the external changes that were taking place. To his more sophisticated analysis, I would add or at least emphasize one further one that has always struck me, which is that I think that the political story that we need to overlay on this analysis is that of the polarization between left and right in Italian society, Italian politics, an inherited polarization from the pre-war era, but one which produced the massive strikes and then quasi-civil war of the 1970s. Italy, after all, is second only to Northern Ireland in the level of political deaths that took place within Western Europe in the post-war period, but certainly in that era. So that polarization, I think, ended up with a political response which exacerbated rigidity, particularly in the labor market. The Workers' Statute, 1970, and the way in which the labor system then became an absolute taboo for the ensuing 30, 40 years is a consequence of a political division, but then has produced a sense of rigidity that produced, I think, two paradoxical outcomes. One is another surprising thing about Italy relative to other European countries, Western European countries, has been the failure in Italy ever to build a comprehensive welfare state, a real social welfare model. Welfare spending has been devoted almost entirely to the pension system, to the public pension system, with the consequence now that public pensions account for 16% of GDP, 50% higher than in most other Western European countries, and that choke away, crowd out other potential uses of public money. Inability to build a welfare model, I think, because of a sort of confrontational politics, and then a combination of that with a need for industrial adjustment that happened because of the oil shock in the 1970s and 1980s, and a rapid expansion of the pension system was used, I would say, as a substitute unemployment insurance program, which has produced one of the earliest retirement ages in Western Europe, in combat with France for that accolade. But nevertheless, that's as it were, has been the outcome. So despite that left-right, you didn't get a proper welfare system. Then we just need to, I think I should say a couple of words about the role of the man we don't mention, who, of course, was a precursor to the American we don't mention. And the question with him is whether he was a symptom or a cause. Was he someone we should hold responsible for some of the trends that appeared in Professor Caposella's charts, or should we see him as a reflection of the system's desire to regain and restore its equilibrium when he entered onto the playing field of politics in 1994 and then dominated it really for the next 20 years? I think that he, as with Trump, was absolutely a symptom, but one who then reinforced the vicious cycles that Professor Caposella described. In thinking about that period of the early 1990s, we should, I think, compare Italy's response and its evolution to two Western European countries that had economic and financial crises at the same time. One was the United Kingdom, ejected from the exchange rate mechanism of European Community at the on the same day as Italy, and Sweden, which had a banking crisis at that time, following actually a very long period of underperformance and some characteristics of which were quite Italian in the sense of a very high inflation rate, successive devaluations, and so forth. Sweden had a banking crisis. Italy had a public finances crisis. We had a sort of more diffuse crisis in the UK. In looking at the response to that, of those three countries, I think clearly Italy performed the worst in responding to that financial crisis and political crisis, and I think the political response, including the sort of successful entry into the game of Berlusconi and of the people who were with him to try to prevent, in a way, effective reform of many institutions, I think have to play a big role in that. Because yes, absolutely, we need to look at the rules of the game, but we also, I think, have to see the way in which the rules of the game have evolved in the 25 years since those crises as being, as Professor Caposella says, a story of somewhat vicious cycles. And when one looks at those, the resort often is to like long historical explanations of responses to foreign invaders and so forth. But I think that that is to say not that these are things that are inevitable in the Italian context, let's say nepotism, predation, the sort of the use of power in a kind of change-limiting way, but rather that they were and became responses to financial stress and economic weakness, that in a period now of scarce resources, of scarce of opportunities, an old response was repeated, one that had been, as it were, unnecessary or at least had evolved out of use during the 1950s and 1960s, and that made things worse. So now, finally, we have to place this against March the 4th, the general election. That produced what Marco Travaglio, a journalist who made his name covering the Mani Pulite trials in Italy, now runs Il Fatto Quotidiano, the most like anti-establishment or anti-elite newspaper originally set up to oppose Berlusconi, now essentially a supporting paper for Five Star. Marco described the election on March the 4th as the Vaffa election, the fuck off the lot of you election. Now, when Andrea described Italy's sort of democracy, or a democracy that usually works, he drew a laugh from you, as if to suggest that the March the 4th election showed that Italy's democracy was somehow malfunctioning. Let me ask us to assess the possibility that actually the result of March the 4th was an entirely appropriate response to precisely the analysis of the political economy of Italy's decline that we've been enjoying and appreciating today. We have an election with a new left, if they are left, Five Star, replacing the PD. We have a new right, the reinvented League, taking over the right from Berlusconi. They now have support in the opinion polls seemingly of more than 60% of the population. They are nominally in favor of reforms of the institutions, of public administration and the judiciary. Five Star stands for the building of a welfare system around the citizens' income. What more could we want? Surely this is the right response. And yet, there is quite a substantial, and actually I should add, another of their attitudes, which seems to me quite right, is that they're particularly interested in rent-seeking private monopolies, in the way in which, in many sectors, the reforms of the 1990s privatized, passed over services such as motorways and bridges, to private monopolies that then became rent seekers. And of course, the Morandi tragedy has emphasized this issue. So the question is, and that we should assess, is given all these problems, can this new government be part of the solution? Certainly as a democratic reaction, they surely are a positive outcome. Now, if you look at the budget, and this is a bit of an unfair assessment in an academic environment, this is a budget that's only just been released with very few details and is the first major act of a government that it came into office only a couple of months ago, so we shouldn't take a great view of it. But I would say there is good and bad. The bad is that very too little, it seems to me, is put on the building of a proper social welfare system to try to help the adjustment process that is necessary. Too much is being put on reversing pension reforms that were kind of necessary for public financial purposes. Too little also is being put on any kind of real structural reforms. Too little so far, as well we know, is being put on public investment in infrastructure. So too much seems to be rearranging, reallocating the capital, and too little on real innovation. But I would suggest for our discussion that we should suspend judgment on this new government, not that I'm a supporter of it, but rather that, given the analysis that Professor Caposella says, we should expect the outcome in Italy to be new governments of this sort, and then we should try to assess what they should do to respond to the problems that he has correctly outlined. I look forward to the discussion.
Good. So we have time for discussion, and actually I would first give an opportunity to Andrea to respond briefly to the comments, to Bill's comments. And, Andrea?
Yes, thank you. Does it work? I'll be very brief because I agree with what you said. I will just make two small comments. One on Berlusconi's symptom, or I mentioned the name. Symptom or cause? I agree, symptom, certainly. And in the book, I try to say that his victory in 94 kind of sealed the victory of the forces of continuity. One reason why continuity prevailed, I think, is that the opposition, the then opposition, the heirs of the Communist Party, had over 45 years, in fact, absorbed the logic of the system in which they were living, and were not capable of reasoning outside of it. So they took 93 as a normal election, except that it was the first election they could really win. They ran on a fairly standard left-wing platform without, if you like, they lacked the ideas that the reformers of the early 60s had. They didn't have the plan of turning Italy around, or at least beginning to turn Italy around. Simply wanted to win the elections, and they were already involved in all the darker side of the Italian equilibrium. So, if you like, they were part of continuity in some sense. Berlusconi won because he was better than that. One small comment on your last remarks on the budget. One thing we know is that the budget is linked to an amnesty for tax evasion. Now, there could be no worse sign than this, especially because the majority coalition partner, the Five Star Movement, has run on a platform of public integrity, rule of law, and so on. And if the first step of your fight against illegality is a tax evasion amnesty, really, you're not credible. You will not change expectations. I return to the issue of the multiple equilibria and the shift between one equilibrium to the next. If you need to change expectations, you need to be credible. Besides the direct damaging effects of the tax amnesty, you have that. Thank you.
Okay. So, thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Bill.
I'm going to take my glasses.
Okay, so let me take a few questions.
Hi. Hello. Ciao. I'm Diana. I am a former LSE student, very, very long time ago, but Really pleased to be here, and thank you very much for the presentation. I have a question on the broader, on the current climate and the current government, and it sort of seems to me that if we really need to take advantage of this moment to reclaim that democratic space to advance real reform, there is a need of sort of for introspection and for a real acknowledgement that the crisis, that the root of the current situation is fundamentally institutional, and that there are external factors, but a lot of those factors are actually national level, sort of, not, I wouldn't say self-inflicted, but, you know, Italians as individuals, but also as institutions, have a lot of to answer for. But what seems to me is that the actual narrative, the discourse, is very much around blaming external factors, whether it's the European Union, whether it's the Mediterranean migrant crisis, etc. I see very little in the public discourse. And how much do you think that that's rhetoric, and therefore we can expect effectively a sort of professional and honest analysis of the Italian malaise that then brings sort of some proper evidence-based solutions? Or do you think it's just, you know, there's, we're sticking the head under the sand again, and therefore we are unlikely to come out of this situation. Thank you.
Both excellent speakers did not once refer to the enormous north-south divide within Italy. Now, all countries in globalized world, especially in Europe, do have significant discrepancies between the rich areas and the poor areas, but it does seem to me that in Italy this is exceptional. Modern Italy is a relatively modern creation, going back only to 1861, which by European standards is positively juvenile. And is it, in your view, is it possible for Italy to remain as a coherent and unified nation state with these growing discrepancies and pressures?
Hi, I was just wondering, you just wonder why there is no a democratic reaction to the situation. And I was wondering if the reason is the fact that what you said as an equilibrium in Italy is perceived as a utopian equilibrium. So we, even on the five-star election, everybody was voting that, thinking, oh, everything will change. But de facto now, if the five-star will enter in the sort of changes you are suggesting, they will lose the election immediately. It's because Italians have not perceived the equilibrium as something real, but just an utopia that another life will occur.
So basically I tend to be positive, as you are, that this is a circle, vicious circle, can be reverted, and it would be fantastic if we managed. But I still believe that to revert it, we need to do reforms. And I would like really to go back to your slide on the reforms of the 90s, because I'm a little bit skeptical that the reforms we did were actually appropriate, if they were, in all cases. I mean, of course, some of them were, some they were less. Some reforms were made and didn't work, like competition law. Some were not even attempted, like the judicial system. Or when you talk about reforms, everyone seems to believe that reforms are just one, but there are many. And the other one that you were mentioning, I think the corruption one, tax evasion, we don't even mention it. Nothing has happened. We have continuously condoning, even now is another one. So it's irrelevant. I mean, I don't think this is something that has ever happened. And I also think some of those reforms were actually detrimental, especially in relation to your famous, with your first slide, the one about the total factor productivity. And in particular, I'm talking about the precarization of the labor force, which was really, really a bad reform. And it has a direct impact on those factors that you consider, and the literature in general considers as the main problem of Italy. So the low skill trap, and the lack of innovation, not to mention all of the other institutional elements. So I do believe that if we do not, that was one of the major mistakes of the Italian capitalist class, believing that by reducing the cost of labor, they would increase competitiveness. So if you can elaborate a bit on this, I have to say that I wrote a book about this. Like, this is why I know something.
Okay, so I would propose that we start on this question. We'll have another round later. We'll start from this question. There's enough material to, if you want to. Yeah.
Thank you. I would deal with the first and the third question together, more or less together, because they are linked. Yes, I do think that Italy needs Italians and Italy needs introspection. I disagree with analysis that blame external factors or blame them too much. The euro is certainly not the cause of Italy's problems, in my view. The euro is part of a context into which Italy's problems become very heavy. They were not heavy in the catch-up phase. Now they have become heavy in a different macroeconomic and external setting. Migrants, of course, is simply the scapegoat identified by demagogues. Nobody can plausibly think that migrants are a problem. Indeed, they're helping the Italian economy and the budget. Introspection, I criticize in the book the so-called cultural explanation, which says, well, Italians are like this, what can you do? You can analyze the behavior of people who accept corruption, clientelism, tax evasion, I think, through the lens of the tension between individual and collective rationality. It may be individually rational in certain circumstances to engage in clientelism. I don't accuse it, but I recognize its rationality. The question is to change the context and the expectations that make it rational. If we understand introspection in the sense of asking oneself, what is my interest? Discussing about ideas that shape one's interest, which is what I wanted to talk about at the end. Danny Roderick, I think, is very persuasive in saying interests in the long term are shaped by ideas. What is my interest? Depends on how I perceive myself, which of my identities is prevalent in respect of a certain choice, what is that identity? What are the ways in which I can realize my hopes? That depends on my views on how the world works. So by discussing about ideas, one can change interests. Introspection, in this sense, would be very healthy in Italy. And I link this to the question of the democratic reaction. That's why I think that I do think that the result of the 4th of March elections is, if you like, a healthy example of dissatisfaction, which could have, perhaps still could, provide the impetus for more change. That, I think, will need a battle of ideas on those questions precisely. What are our interests? What kind of society are we, Italians? What kind of society do we want to be? We would need the kind of debate that underpinned the reformist program of the early 60s, which we never had since. And then maybe the discontent that translated itself into the vote we saw on the 4th of March might perhaps find a more constructive, a more useful outlet. That will, of course, require different and better political organizations and so on. So the list of what should happen is long. Now, North-South divide, not mentioned, yes, true. Even in the book it's not too mentioned, because what I try to say is that these problems are much more homogeneous across the country than the obvious differences between North and South would suggest. And they also can be inscribed into an equilibrium in which one set of distortions feeds and sustains the others. And my argument in one word is that in the South you see the most visible manifestations of Italy's problems, of that spiral, if you like, interspersed, of course, with very encouraging examples of civic and economic vitality, which I've seen myself. I did some voluntary work in Calabria and I saw it. And in the south, you also have the biggest reservoir of underused or badly used resources, human, intellectual, material resources. So the south, if things begin to change, the south is the reservoir for an Italian growth jump. There is so much margin that there is there for higher growth that it could help. On reforms, I agree. Many were done. Maybe not all were appropriate. I fully agree. There is a big debate about the question of labor flexibility. I do see your argument. I don't go very much into it. I do see your argument that it can have harmed productivity. This is a theoretical argument discussed elsewhere in respect of also other countries. In the specific Italian case, I think these arguments are particularly strong because this was a discussion in a previous seminar this afternoon. In Italy, for example, there is a lot of on-the-job training, also because formal skills tend to be not needed or low. So flexibility is harmful for that. And I do agree that as part of the defensive strategy of the private sector, which after the 70s we see very clearly that large firms are withdrawing from the higher technology, most capital intensive sectors, and at the end they try to compete on cost rather than on innovation. I do see this. It is a problem. I think in some sense, I don't want to hang everything on that peg, but it's part of this problem. Thank you.
Okay, I will just address a few of these, starting with the precarization or whatever one says, the ultra-flexibility of the Biagi law and others. I agree that this had a very detrimental effect, but we need to be careful in thinking why, and the big reason is that it was that the rock of the protected sector was left unreformed, and this is the same in Japan, it's the same in many other countries, that because there's a taboo about the regular employee, the young women, others are basically thrown under a bus and given short-term contracts and precarious work, and that steadily grows over time. This produces two, I think, has produced two deleterious outcomes. One is a long-term problem of weak household incomes and therefore weak household demand and a dramatically declining savings rate because simply over the last 25 to 30 years, new generations have been unable to kind of build the incomes that were necessary for it. I think second problem is the human capital formation problem, the low skills trap. Again, this is absolutely the same in Japan. If you have a tradition of on-the-job training and you have a strong human capital formation through that, if you shift to a system of short-term precarious contracts, human capital is dissipated and not accumulated, and you end up in that area. I think what was necessary was a broader labor reform combined with the building of a welfare system and real job adjustment help and so on, but that, for various reasons, couldn't happen. So that has produced part of the backdrop to this March the 4th election. The voters of Five Star Movement are substantially among the young, who are the precarious voters, and substantially the parents and grandparents of the young who feel that the next generations have no hope or that they have to come and study at the LSE. So this produces a question about is this new government serious? Is there a real debate? I think that if you look at the dynamics of this government since it was formed, the loudest noises have been from Matteo Salvini on the right, who is from a party and a tradition that actually doesn't really want to do some of the reforms that we've discussed and that finds foreigners a much more attractive enemy. On the left, or left and center of the Five Star Movement, there's been much more discussion about the national nature of the issues. I wouldn't necessarily agree with all the analysis, but nevertheless, there's been a sense of taking it seriously, and I think a move away from blaming the external environment. But that's what's going to be interesting, as they say, about this government, the dynamic of these two really quite different parts in following through. And finally, just on the north-south divide, I mean, I think that I would agree very much with what Andrea said, and I would add to it simply that two comments. One, in some ways, you should not see Italy as a unified state today. It's a very decentralized state, and it's a rather diversified state. Secondly, you have to think of Italy as not as north-south, but as north-center-south. Really, this is not a bifurcated country. It's basically a variegated country across three very different regions, that's too simple. And thirdly, I think the political response in the South, which was to basically vote five star in these elections and try to, in a way, cast at least put two fingers up to clientelism of a traditional sort, may suggest some positive view, but we'll see what happens.
Okay, so we have time for maybe two questions. One over there. Yeah.
I wonder whether the term decline, tuku, isn't a bit strong. Of course, the growth of Italy, of the Italian economy over the past 20 years is an impressive. There is an interesting parallel. The growth hasn't been strong, but population growth has been negative. There is a parallel here one can make with Japan. Japan also is a country which we could consider in decline, and for those of you who traveled to Japan, you can say that this declining country is doing okay, and its citizens look to be satisfied with the world in which they live. With respect to Italy, you haven't mentioned something which strikes me as a fellow European. You have the second manufacturing industry in Europe. You're second to Germany only. You're more important than Britain and France. That's one thing. Second, could you believe it? You have a current account surplus. You have a trade surplus, a current account surplus. So you've got a there are Italians who are competitive in the world as it is today. So you're not about to drop out of history.
That was a question up there. Yeah.
So both of you have talked a lot about institutional reforms, and you basically haven't mentioned any specifically. Could you maybe enumerate a few that would be, you know, that policymakers should be thinking about in the future, or, you know, or what sort of concrete things do you think would be required for Italy, you know, to get on and up to this, you know, better equilibrium or into a better state?
Thank you. Andrea.
Yes, thank you. Whether decline is too strong a word, I do spend some time to discuss this in the book. I think really the main reason why I think it is possible to talk about decline is the dynamic of TFP, which has been dropping ever since 1980. Now, TFP really is the heart of the progress of prosperity in a country. Headline growth was fairly strong in the 80s, but things below the surface were the roots of growth were eroding, and they are still eroding today. Now, there is a splendid book on the way, it is called The Welfare of Italians, published by Giovanni Vecchi for Oxford last year, which follows all chapters, education, health, looks at the height of people and so on. And he concludes that, looking at per capita growth, Italy is in relative decline, is not yet in absolute decline. And the inference, if you like, is that if current trends continue, it will go into absolute decline. Now, this is compatible with having the second largest manufacturing sector in Europe. It depends on which kind of firms are these manufacturers, in which kind of sectors they operate, in which kind of technologies they specialize. And I don't deal with it because I had no space and no time for it. But I suspect that the demography of Italy can be linked to this. The snapshot is that of a country that is uncertain about the future. Few children and so on. But even the level of home ownership, you know, it's an invest, kind of your own self-assurance, reassurance for the future. Even the trade surpluses are compatible with that, especially if they are, as in some cases they are, chiefly based on cost competitiveness, to the extent that still can be done in the face of China. Now, institutional reforms, some specifically, well, I mean, my argument, I talk about the reforms and I kind of bemoan the fact that they had not worked. But I also say that if this is true and if there are underlying strong political economic reasons why the reforms didn't work, well, then I have little patience for those who come up with lists of the reforms that Italy now needs to do and they are urgent. Because changing even more laws will not change much. What you would need is a credible, coherent political program, a program directed at changing the country in some way, which includes reforms. Then we can discuss which reforms should go first, which reforms should be in the list, how to sequence them, etc. We were discussing the other day with Professor Larcinese that, for example, it might help if you are tackling, if you like, sectoral regulations or sectoral privileges or whatever. It might be useful to do horizontal reforms that tackles all categories at the same time in order not to have to fight one after the other in succession, because there you have the typical problem of the organized minority defeating the disorganized majority. But these are issues that become relevant only after you have a credible political program for changing the country, capable of changing citizens' expectations. Then these reforms will work. And often reforms will in effect be simply giving real life to the reforms we already have in the books. Italy, I think, is the country that did most structural reforms in all definitions of the notion since the 90s. So many of these reforms would have to, you know, would have to become real, or to be would have to become more real.
Well, we're running out of time, so I wouldn't want to add too much to the list of institutional reforms. But I would focus very much myself on two things. One is absolutely the justice system. I think that in terms of, if you ask the question, what deters investment in Italy? What deters businesses from investing? What deters them investing, whether they're British, I mean, German, Japanese, or anyone, or Italian, it is essentially the uncertainty of contract law, or the delays in the justice system, and so on. At least this is a problem for businesses of scale. And I would emphasize that. And secondly, I think that the construction, which is very difficult, of a genuine welfare system that acts as a combination of unemployment insurance and job adjustment assistance, therefore takes the subsidy away from the companies and gives it to the person. Traditionally, unemployment insurance systems in Italy have essentially been corporate subsidies and not helping the individual. So this would be to take literally what the five-star claims its ambition is with the citizens' income. It is actually a Nordic, it is presented as a Nordic-style flexicurity proposal. It could have been in the manifesto of Macron. It absolutely could be seen to be following a Scandinavian idea. The question is whether they're really serious about doing this and whether the public administration in locally who would have to implement this are capable of implementing such a system. But it is, I would say, in the right direction. So finally, how gloomy or whatever should we be? I would say yes, but on a GDP per capita basis, Italy is also badly underperformed. If you look at the sort of G5, G6 order up until 1980, Japan was number one, Italy was number two. If you look at it post-1990, Italy is the bottom, Japan is second bottom. So basically, they go. Now, does this produce misery and falling off the pages of history? No, of course it doesn't. I agree with that. But I wouldn't be personally too reassured by manufacturing. It's declined. It's 15% of GDP. We need to worry about the other 85% of GDP. Italian manufacturing is great, but it tends to be in relatively smaller companies that are not, as a stylized fact, not scaling up and therefore not being able to create large amounts of employment. So it is not producing, as it were, income generation. The traditional idea of kind of the heyday of manufacturing producing highly paid middle class jobs and so forth of the sort that that Donald Trump talks about has long gone, really, and that's why the British car industry produces more every year than the Italian car industry, despite all our problems. So I think manufacturing is good, but not, unfortunately, an answer to the questions that we need. Keep it, cherish it, etc. Current account surplus is absolutely a good reason why not we shouldn't expect a financial crisis in Italy, why we shouldn't expect either exit from the euro as being a serious or a possibility. But again, it doesn't answer enough of the questions for the long term.
Okay, so I'm afraid we have to draw this event to a close. I'm the one who keeps the time. I have many questions I would have liked to ask our guests. You can't really say I've exploited my powers here as a chair, but, so I would like to thank you, Andrea Capussela. Thank you, Bill Emmott, for being here with us. And maybe we'll see each other again for some event in the future where, we'll have better news about Italy, hopefully.